the magnitude of her father's imposition on Wallace. How could she have been so stupid? How could she not have realized Wallace didn't want her and Jamie? Only because Wallace was too kind to let on. She got into bed and looked out at the lit window of the cottage. Tears came, but she blinked them back. For as long as she could remember, she had planned to leave Missoula as soon as she got big enough. But now her resolve was tugged into trim, made taut like a sail. In the morning, Wallace drove them all to the field. And after the Breyfogles pumped air into the plane's tires and topped up the water in their radiators, the three Graveses watched Felix's Jenny bump across the badger-holed grass, Felix flying from the rear cockpit and Trixie riding in front. As they flew low over downtown, Trixie climbed onto the bottom wing and leaned out, gripping the rigging wires and shouting down through a megaphone in her best carnival barker's voice about the flying Breyfogles, today only. Lindbergh special only $4 a ride. Come on up. Aerobatics at 2. Parachute jump at 2:30. After they came back and landed, Trixie told Marion to get in the front cockpit of her plane for a ride. Couple of gals aloft together, she said, more to Wallace than to Marion, who was doing a poor job concealing her disappointment over not going up with Felix. Trixie wore a leather cap and goggles, but Marion was bareheaded, fully exposed, as she wished to be. By the time Lindbergh landed, he had spent 30 hours and 30 minutes in the air and been awake for 55. To keep from falling asleep, he'd flown low enough over the ocean to feel the salt spray. The waves had risen out of the dark like furrows plowing themselves up from a black field. He had circled, confused, over the airport at Le Bourget. Bright, winding tributaries of light flowed out from the yellow lake of Paris, surrounded what should have been a deserted patch of grass, shut up for the night. Cars, of course. 100,000 people had driven out to Le Bourget to see him land. Just after Felix and Trixie concluded their show with Felix's daring parachute jump, word of Lindbergh's safe arrival reached Missoula. Felix had landed and was gathering his parachute when church bells rang and sirens sounded. The crowd at the airfield stirred, murmured about Lindbergh. But no one knew for sure until a man tore up in a runabout, sounding his horn and shouting, "He's landed! He's landed in Paris!" People embraced. They threw hats and handkerchiefs. In France, the crowd at the aerodrome had nearly pulled Lindbergh and his plane apart in their mad adulation. Thousands of people all reaching for the tall man, the salt-crusted wings. In Missoula, the road to the airfield filled with cars and bicycles and people on foot. So many wanted rides in the Jennies that the gasoline man had to be summoned with his truck to keep the Breyfogles in fuel until sunset. Everyone wanted to be closer to the plains, to the sky, to look down on the town and pretend to be Lindbergh. Lindbergh, who was permitted to sleep, finally, at the ambassador's residence in Paris, his strange future already pulling him along. But before, back in the morning, back when Marion was about to go up with Trixie for her ride, Lindbergh had still been somewhere over England. "Switch off," Felix had called, standing in front of the plane. "Switch off," Trixie answered from the rear cockpit. Felix grabbed the propeller and pulled it around a couple times. He took a firm hold and braced his feet. "Contact! Contact!" Felix swung the blade. There were a few short blasts of clipped sound, like cards being shuffled, as the engine roused itself. A few puffs of smoke, an acrid smell. Then a rhythmic churn. the turning crankshaft, the snare tattoo of the prop. Marion watched through the windshield as the blades blurred to invisibility. A wind came up in the cockpit. The plane jostled in place, wanting to fly. She tugged tight the wide seatbelt across her thighs. They rolled forward, picked up speed, bounced across ruts and mounds until the nose dropped, and there was no more bouncing but skimming, the grass a blur. Upward pressure from below the wings. They rose, the stick and throttle and rudder pedals in Marion's cockpit, which Trixie had cautioned her not to touch, moved as though manipulated by a ghost. The earth fell away. People and cars moved along Missoula's streets like pieces in an inscrutable game. Over the river, an osprey flew briefly alongside, clutching a fish in its talons. Heading down the valley, Trixie pulled abruptly up and without warning executed first a roll and then a loop. She swooped high above the mountains, put the plane into a spin. The valley rotated around them. The engine changed pitch. The wires hummed. Droplets of hot water from the radiator stung Marion's face. Trixie pulled out and flew up again, going high before nosing into a dive. Marion knew she was supposed to be frightened, that Trixie was trying to make her recant her wish to fly. But while the earth rushed up from below and her guts pressed into her ribs and her body into the seat, she felt only lightness. Missoula, October 1927, 5 months after the Breyfogles came and went. Jamie, Marion said, I need you to cut my hair. Jamie was lying on his bed with a volume of Audubon prints Marion had forbidden him from taking out of the cottage. From the doorway, she eyed the book but didn't remark on it. In one hand, she held Barrett's long scissors. She pointed the blades at him. Please?
Cut it how?
She pulled her braid around over her shoulder, with two fingers mimed cutting it off at the base. Like that. Jamie looked appalled. Barrett would kill us. But she couldn't glue it back on. I'll cut it myself if I have to.
So do it.
You'll do it better. Also, she wanted company in her decision, the reassurance of an accomplice.
I've never cut anyone's hair.
You know how things should look.
Not hair.
Please.
No.
She pulled her braid taut with one hand and raised the scissors behind her head with the other.
You wouldn't, Jamie said.
The tendons in her wrist stood out as the blades gnawed, coming together with a grinding sound. The pale braid flopped over in her hand like a dead bouquet. She touched her mangled nape, felt a close-cropped patch in back with long bits sprouting around it like weeds. The rest fell forward around her ears in hunks. She'd wanted sleekness, lightness, not this. Amusement fought with horror on Jamie's face.
Now you've done it, he said.
Temper flashed through her.
You wouldn't help me. You should have helped me.
She ran downstairs and out to the cottage, fuming helplessly. It seemed to her that Jamie had an obligation to go along with her whims. He should have recognized her determination as immovable and done as she'd asked. She'd closed the scissors partly to punish him for his doubt she would follow through. In the cottage, she sat in the armchair and tenderly stroked the back of her head. She cried rarely and only if she knew no one would see. The morning her father left, she had only cried after she'd ridden Fiddler far up the rattlesnake. But now she chanced a few tears before she passed a hand under her nose and got up to light the wood stove. She knew Jamie would come soon to console her, and everything would be all right again. From the ceiling of the cottage dangled a squadron of cardboard and tissue paper airplanes. After the Breyfogles left, she had read whatever she could find about pilots and flying,
in Missoula's handsome brick Carnegie Library. Since Lindbergh, the whole country had caught aviation fever, and besides the columns of coverage in the papers every day, new periodicals kept springing up. In the back of one magazine promising daring tales of flight and flying, she had found instructions and stencils for making a model of a standard biplane. That first one hadn't turned out well. Its wings were crooked and dotted with gluey fingerprints. The struts were buckled. But she made another and another, lavishing them with the attention she longed to expend on real aircraft. And eventually, they were perfect. At some point in the first weeks post Breyfogle's, as she lay earthbound and pining in the cottage, lost in heady memories of the valley spinning below, of the high harmonic of the plane's rigging, the obvious fact had dawned on her that she could not become a pilot right away. She needed to be older. Not much older, she didn't think, just not 13. Maybe 14 or 15. She believed then she would be old enough that her intentions would not seem comical. She would also need a flying teacher and an airplane, but she did not doubt those would materialize. Another undeniable truth had occurred to her. If she hadn't been able to pay Trixie for a ride, she certainly wouldn't be able to pay for proper lessons, and so she had begun to look for income more dependable than petty thievery. 16 was the age for real work. 14, if you had a school leaving certificate, which she didn't. The librarians would pay her a dime for every cart of books she shelved, but there were not enough carts. Farmers would not hire a girl to pick apples or milk cows when there were boys after the same jobs. Opportunities were limited, but she would find a way because she must be a pilot. She couldn't fathom that others did not see her for what she would become, that she did not wear the fact of her future like some eye-catching garment. Her belief that she would fly saturated her world, presented an appearance of absolute truth. It was Caleb who came to the cottage, not Jamie. She had fallen asleep in the armchair and woke to him standing over her, purloined Audubon under his arm. His hair was bound back in a braid thicker than the one she'd cut off. He laughed, high and wheezy, almost a neigh, while peering at the back of her head. "What have you done?" "I wanted it short." She dreaded him asking why. To explain it would be impossible. Because tender lumps had recently begun deforming her chest? Because she had read something in one of her father's books about nuns shaving their heads as they entered their novitiate, and wanted to mark herself with the seriousness of her intention to fly? Because she wanted to strip everything extra away, be streamlined and clean and swift? Caleb didn't ask why. He set the book down and said, "Were you crying because your hair is gone, or because you did such a bad job of it?"
"I'm not crying."
He smiled, patronizing. She ran her hand over her naked neck, said,
"Because I did a bad job."
She was relieved to recognize this as the truth.
"Can you help, maybe?"
"I don't see how I could make it any worse." Jamie was too scared to come try.
They spread newspaper on the floor and she sat in the middle. Carefully, slowly, using a comb and just the points of the scissors, he snipped.
"I cut Gilda's hair sometimes," he said.
"You do?"
"I just trim the ends. She's never given me such a mess to start with." "How short do you want it?"
"Like a boy's."
"I'm a boy and mine's longer than yours ever was."
"You know what I mean. Real short."
"All right."
Snipping.
"You know, since you already dress like a boy, people will take you for one after this."
"That's fine."
"Don't you want to be a girl?"
"Would you want to be a girl?"
"Of course not." Well, then.
But sometimes I wish I were fully white.
She felt cold metal against her neck. The scratch of the comb, the unhurried touch of his fingertips.
Why don't you cut off your braid, then?
Short hair won't make me white.
No, but having long hair makes you seem more different than you are.
I'm not ever going to be fully white, so there's no point. I don't care what people think, and they should know that.
So you do care what people think?
No.
You care that they know you don't care what they think.
All right, maybe a little.
After a minute, she said,
Maybe I cut my hair for the same reason you don't cut yours.
Maybe.
Silence, except for the blades. He said,
I heard a story once about a woman who really turned into a man.
What do you mean, really turned into a man?
She was Kootenai. An old guy in Shacktown told me.
He said 100 years ago there'd been a woman who married a white man in one of the traders' parties, but acted too wild and got sent away. She went back to her people and told them the white men had turned her into a man. After that, she was a man.
You can't just be a man.
She even took a wife. She gave herself different names, too. The only one I remember is Sitting in the Water Grizzly.
Then what?
She told people she was a prophet. She rubbed everyone the wrong way, and eventually someone killed her and cut out her heart.
He set down the scissors, said,
You're not going to win no beauty pageant, but it's better than it was.
She ran a hand over the back of her head. It felt smoother than before.
There's no mirror in here.
Don't you trust me?
I'd trust a mirror more.
She stood and tried to look at her reflection in the window. All she could make out was a small head, round and pale.
But anything would be better than it was.
Suddenly agitated, he scooped up the newspaper and crunched it into a ball that he tossed into the stove.
Don't you want to know what I charge for haircuts?
Nervousness down low in her. It had been a couple of years since they'd played any of his games, but he'd taken on that needling jumpiness he used to get before he proposed one. Games of captivity. Games where the rules involved taking off clothes. Touching.
Don't you ever just do a friend a favor?
Sure, he said. Sometimes. I've done you lots of favors.
An acrid smell emanated from the stove.
Caleb, she said, why did you throw that in there with all the hair in it? It stinks.
Listen, the price is a kiss. Kissing was never a part of any of their games. She laughed, more shocked than if he'd suggested she strip naked. It's not that I'm sweet on you, he said. I want to practice for when I have a real girl.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Pay up.
When she made no move, he gave an exaggerated sigh and came to her, looking into her face, sardonic and unafraid. It seemed impossible they would press their mouths together. But then they did. Or he pressed his to hers. Hard. She sealed her lips tight together, pulled away. He smirked.
Next time you want a haircut, you'll have to kiss better than that.
Next time I want a haircut, I'll go to a barber.
Someone's got to teach you how to kiss.
No, they don't.
Don't be chicken.
I'm not.
Sure you are. You're shaking. I can see it.
She willed herself to stop.
Maybe I just don't want to kiss you.
The smirk came back.
That's not it.
After he'd gone, she sat stroking her head. A pressure built between her legs. She put her fist there.
sparks like dandelion fluff. Was she chicken? She wasn't sure if she'd felt fear or only embarrassment. If she had returned Caleb's kiss, let his tongue into her mouth, she would have been admitting she wanted to be kissed, that she wanted in general. Did she want? Pressure again. Some intuition. She was more afraid of the admitting than of the doing. She ran her hand over her shorn head again, felt a stirring of pride mixed up with the pressure that was tightening in her like a bolt being turned into place. Her hair was a declaration, not an admission. All things should be declarations, not admissions. She pressed forward onto her fist as though riding a horse uphill, swayed on it. Soon she couldn't get enough leverage and moved to sit astride the arm of the chair, thought of the beastly man with his face between Gilda's legs, devouring, of Felix Brayfogle holding her shins, of Caleb's mouth, urged herself on until she was emptied of all thoughts. An incomplete history of sitting in the water grizzly. Circa 1790 to 1837. She is born at the end of the 18th century in what will be Idaho, just outside a Kootenai winter camp. She falls from her mother, who has walked and squatted all night, and the frosty dawn air slaps her into a scream. An ordinary girl from the look of her. The story is patchy, contradictory, a mixture of gossip from both white men and native people, fermented almost into myth. When the time comes to marry, she is 13 and big-boned, quick-tempered. She knows how to collect and prepare food, how to weave rush mats, how to do 100 other things. But no man wants her for a wife. Spurned, she bores holes in the sturgeon-nosed canoe of the man she likes best. A group of white men pass nearby, the retinue of the trader and mapmaker David Thompson. And in the night, she leaves camp, makes her way through the forest. In the morning, Thompson's servant, called Boisvert, emerges from his tent and finds a native girl staring at him. At first, he's afraid she might be a ghost, but she drops to her knees, crawls to him across the rocks and dirt. Boisvert has been waiting his whole life for a woman to do exactly this. Boisvert's new wife, the girl who came out of the woods, is no trouble in the beginning. She is eager to help in the camp, eager in Boisvert's bed, never tires. When the men can barely keep trudging forward, she races high-spiritedly through the trees. She learns English quickly and some French. She laughs when the men shoot at animals and miss. When they have to cross a river, she strips off her clothing without shame and wades in, brazenly meeting the men's eyes. Plenty of Thompson's men lack wives, and Madame Boisvert proves to be generous and obliging, strong and tireless. Her raucous laugh comes from a different tent every night, even though Boisvert beats her for it or tries to. She fights back, gives him black eyes and swollen lips to match her own. She has to go, David Thompson says. He fears Boisvert might kill her and doesn't want the hassle. She must return to her own people. Again, she walks through the forest. She doesn't know where her people are exactly. They take a bit of finding. With a gun she took from the white man, she hunts for food. Prowling among the trees, she imagines herself a warrior. And an idea presents itself. More than an idea, a truth, unnoticed before. It turns out, she announces when she has rejoined the Kootenai, that white men have supernatural powers, and they have used those powers to change her into a man. She starts dressing as a man, This man gives himself a new name, Gone to the Spirits. He hunts and fishes, refuses to do women's work. He gets a horse to go with his gun, invites himself along on a raid. The warriors tell him to go away, but he follows, camps in the darkness just outside their circle. In battle, he takes 3 horses and 2 scalps. Not bad at all. A man wants a wife. Gone to the Spirits starts approaching girls who know how to collect and prepare food, how to weave. But they don't want him. He rants and rages. He claims that the white men's supernatural powers have rubbed off on him, that everyone should think carefully before crossing him, because who knows what punishments he might call down. There is a word, berdash. Not a perfect word, not even close. French for catamite, meaning a young boy kept by an older man, derived through muddled Spanish and Italian from an old Persian word for slave. White trappers and traders and explorers from the time of their earliest forays among the natives had encountered people who weren't quite men and weren't quite women. What to call them? Some forgotten soul shrugged and offered a half-remembered insult his mother back in Montreal had spat at his older brother. The word spread, took hold. Gone to the Spirits flits in and out of the diaries of traders and explorers. He bestows prophecies on the native people. It starts as simple boasting. He tells them that not only did he change himself from a woman into a man, he has other supernatural powers too, like prophecy. Then give us a prophecy. Well, for example, some giants are coming. Soon, they will overturn the earth and bury all the tribes. Smallpox is coming too, again. White men are bringing it, again. But, fortunately for you, Gone to the Spirits can perform rites of protection, for the right price. Warily, people give him gifts in exchange for his rights. But since they don't like his prophecies, they don't like him either. He becomes more popular when he starts foretelling a great white chief who is angry at the other lesser white men, the ones they've met, because he'd told the white men to give away his treasures, not trade for them. He will soon be sending riches and gifts as an apology and will punish the others for their greed. Soon. When he meets her, his wife is sitting beside a lake. She isn't doing work of any kind, and the strange sight of a woman who is not busy makes him think she doesn't have a man. He skips stones into the water as they talk. Her husband has abandoned her. She is deciding what to do. He asks, "Do you want a new husband?" He has already made a buffalo leather phallus he thinks might fool a wife, but his wife is no fool. She is, like him, a loud laugher, a brawler. Their first night, she grabs the counterfeit cock from his grasp, laughs at its wishful size. Before he can stop her, she's pulled up his shirt to laugh at his breasts. He holds her down and finds a way to press and rub against her that gives them both pleasure. She joins him, traveling and prophesying. She tells someone about the buffalo hide phallus, and soon everyone knows. Gone to the Spirits suspects her of sleeping with other men and beats her, though she denies straying. She doesn't want anything to do with the cock, she insists. Hasn't she made that clear? They wind up at Astoria, on the Oregon coast. In their journals, the Astorian traders note the arrival of a husband and wife, dressed like Plains Indians in leather robes and moccasins and leggings. The husband speaks English and French, a little Cree and a little Algonquin, other native languages too, but none of the coastal dialects. He dazzles the Astorians by drawing an accurate map of the rivers and mountains to the east. If any man comes near his wife, he grows menacing, will even draw his knife. He gambles. He can't hold his drink. he learns the coastal dialects. David Thompson shows up at some point. "Bless my boots," he says. "If it isn't Madame Boisvert." The Astorians scratch their heads, wonder how they hadn't seen it. Gone to the Spirits twitches his hand toward his knife. But really, he is pleased to have met this white man again, to have the chance to show him he is no longer in his power. July 1811. They all decide to go up the Columbia River. Thompson is making his way back to Canada. The Astorians plan to erect a trading post in the interior. Gone to the Spirits offers his services as a guide. One day, as the party travels up the river, they find four men waiting for them with seven huge salmon to trade. The lower jaws of the fish have been run through with poles that rest on the men's shoulders. Their tails brush the ground. "Is it true?" these men ask David Thompson, casting dark looks at Gone to the Spirits, "that you are bringing smallpox? And also giants to bury our camps and villages?" "No," says Thompson. "No, no, no. Certainly not." In his journal, Thompson writes, "I told them not to be alarmed, for the white men who had arrived had not brought the smallpox, and the natives were strong to live, and, such as it was in the day of your grandfathers, it is now, and will continue the same for your grandsons. But nothing will be the same for their grandsons." At some point, the party splits. Thompson heads north, telling the story of the bird ash as he goes. A surefire anecdote, always a hit. The Astorians continue east, Gone to the Spirits and Mrs. Gone to the Spirits accompanying them. Thanks to optimistic prophecies, the Gone to the Spirits household has grown to include 26 horses heaped with goods. One evening, the Gone to the Spiritses ride off without a word of farewell, and for a time, go unremarked upon by white men. When he reemerges, Gone to the Spirits has acquired a new wife, but lost the 26 horses. Starts showing up around the Flathead trading post near Missoula. He appears in the journals of the white men there as Bundosh, or Bodash. He comes with groups of Kootenai to trade furs and get liquor, which makes him noisy. For pay, he'll translate the Flathead and Blackfoot languages. There's a story. Gone to the Spirits was traveling with a band of warriors. At river crossings, he always dallied behind, and another man grew suspicious and hid in the trees to watch him undress. Saw Gone to the Spirits had breasts and no cock, though he claimed to have been fully transformed into a man. Gone to the Spirits, naked in the water, caught sight of the spy and crouched down, concealing himself. Later, when they came to Lake Pend'Oreille, the chief said the warriors could pick new names if they wanted, since their raids had been unsuccessful and they needed something to shake off the malaise. "I will be sitting in the water, Grizzly," said Gone to the Spirits, trying to make the best of a bad situation. "You sit, but you're no Grizzly," said the spy. "Sitting in the water, Grizzly," drew his knife, but was driven off before any blood was spilled. He becomes an unlikely peace messenger, running among the tribes, translating. Bird ashes are natural go-betweens, not too much any one thing. Two spirits, they're sometimes called now. In 1837, a band of Flathead is surrounded by Blackfeet. Sitting in the water, Grizzly brings a misleading message to the Blackfeet to stall them while the Flathead escape. When the Blackfoot warriors understand they have been deceived, they stab him in the gut. Another story. Sitting in the water, Grizzly's wounds keep closing as though by magic, until one warrior has the idea to make a deep gouge and reach in and cut off a piece of his beating heart. After that, when his heart is no longer whole, his wounds stop sealing themselves, and Sitting in the Water Grizzly dies. So he didn't have powers, some people say when they hear. He died like anyone else would. so we can disregard all he said because he didn't know any more than we do.
But, others say, I've heard his body lay in the forest for a long time without decaying, and no animals or birds touched it. That's odd, isn't it? Maybe it means something.
Maybe, people say, it might. It could.
Grace Kelly. 4. Not long before we broke up, Oliver and I had put on hats and sunglasses and gone out in the middle of the day to a superhero movie, the 9th one in a series. He'd seen all the others. I hadn't seen any. I sat in the dark, tugging on leathery red vines until there was dull pain in my incisors, watching a violent fever dream of huge, luminous faces, caroming bodies, buildings toppling and machines crashing and bursts of fire. Somewhere in a dark and gleaming room was a locked briefcase, and in that briefcase was a vial of mysterious white light, and whoever possessed the vial could either save or destroy the world. The fantasy, I said to Oliver afterward, is that you, Joe moviegoer, might also possess extraordinary powers and not even know it, or you might at any moment be transformed into someone who does. But the fantasy is also about containment. Ungovernable forces come to roost inside heroic human bodies, or are shrunk down and carted around in vials and briefcases. The end of everything is held inside a tiny ball of light.
Yeah, I guess, Oliver said. But mostly I like how the story keeps getting bigger. Like it's not even just a universe anymore. It's an extended universe. Like you don't even know how much more there might be.
I said there was no such thing as an extended universe. A universe either was or wasn't. Something couldn't be more than infinity.
It's just an expression, Oliver said.
I was hauled in for a shaming session with some studio executives and sentenced to lunch with Gwendolyn, the author of Archangel, and tasked with appeasing her. Then we'll see, they said. They kept alluding ominously to decisions to be made going forward. And Siobhan did her best to defend my right to a personal life. But nobody was buying it. I sat there sullenly, not saying anything until, when prompted, I said, no. I didn't know what I'd been thinking with Jones. And no, I didn't think Oliver and I would get back together. And no, it hadn't been my best idea to leave the club by the front door. In Hollywood, lunch is where dreams are made and broken. Anything can happen at lunch. Lunch is the alpha and omega. Behind every film is a mountain of spicy tuna, an ocean of San Pellegrino. No dessert for me, but do you have cold brew? With almond milk. Thanks. When I arrived, Gwendolyn had already been seated. Her fluffy little white dog was under her chair, surveilling everyone's feet. Because she took her dog everywhere, Gwendolyn always chose restaurants with patios. And this particular patio was in a hotel's jungly courtyard under angular maroon sunshade things that looked like the sails of a pirate ship. She watched me approach without smiling, her hands folded in her lap, her platform heels barely touching the floor. She's 5 feet tall at most, and I felt like a courtier granted an audience with a malevolent child queen. The ripple of excitement that followed me across the patio must have bugged the hell out of Gwendolyn. Even if everyone was only talking about what a slut I am and plotting how to surreptitiously take my picture. Hey, Gwendolyn, I said in a slow, cracking stoner voice. Hey, Poochie,
I said to the dog, its black button eyes burning with anxious outrage. Usually, Gwendolyn would make a big show of standing up and wrapping her dinky arms around my shoulders and holding her hips a mile away while I stooped awkwardly over her, and usually she would say something like, "There's my gorgeous girl." She was only in her late 40s, so I don't know why she always talked like she was my grandmother. This time, though, she just sat there and stared like she was trying to turn me to stone with her mind. Or maybe she couldn't move her face. She's starting to have work done. In 20 years, she'll be a skin balloon with eye holes. "I know, right?" I said in response to her silence as I flopped into my chair. "Totally." The waiter was all over me, draping my napkin across my lap, handing me the wine list, running through all the water options. Gwendolyn's dog yapped, and she dragged the little pea brain into her lap, saying, "He thinks he's big." Literally every person with a small dog makes that exact same joke literally every day. "Must be hard being that dumb," I said. I ordered a vodka soda.
"Someone's been busy,"
Gwendolyn said when the waiter was gone. "Me?" I frowned and considered, like, what has been going on with me? "Not really. I'm basically under house arrest. Oliver always said I should put in an underground bowling alley, and now I wish I had."
"I hope you don't expect me to feel sorry for you."
Here's a key fact about Gwendolyn. Gwendolyn wrote the Archangel books because she dreamed up Gabriel as a dorky sex fantasy and fell in love with him. She was working the night shift at some resort where people have conferences about medical devices and accounting software. And she was spending most of her time sitting behind the desk reading fat paperbacks about dragons and sexy wizards. And she came up with this magical pseudo-Russian dystopian world and told herself stories about forbidden teen love. Then, one day she was like, fuck it, and started writing it all down. A good decision, financially. Here's another key fact. Gwendolyn got confused like all the other crazy bitches and mistook Oliver the actor for Gabriel the character and fell in love with him. She'd light up like a Roman candle every time he was around, all fizzing and erratic and scary, and flirt relentlessly in a creepy motherly way. I think she thought because Oliver once married an older woman, she had a chance. But Oliver's ex-wife was cool to a galactic degree, like David Bowie or Charlotte Gainsbourg, and therefore ungoverned by age. Plus, Oliver was a teenager when he met his ex, romantic and susceptible. And now he's a movie star who hangs out with other movie stars and cheats on movie stars with models and singers and probably random normals, too.
"I'm going to be honest," Gwendolyn said. "I'm deeply concerned about the way you're representing Archangel."
"I'm not sure what you mean."
"Spare me, Hadley."
It came out in a deep, ragged voice I'd never heard before. Like she'd started to transform into a monster. Suddenly, I was too tired to keep messing with Gwendolyn. "I was 18 when I signed on for this," I told her. "I didn't know what I was getting into."
"Right. How could you ever have anticipated becoming very rich and famous when you auditioned for a series of movies based on wildly best-selling books? What possible precedents could there have been?"
"I know, but this isn't even, like, normal famous. It's a fame tsunami."
"I don't think you should make light of tsunamis," she said.
The waiter materialized with my vodka soda, all chipper and professional, like he didn't notice how tense we were. Like he hadn't waited for the most awkward possible moment to pop in.
"Are we ready to order?"
"Cheeseburger, no bun," I said.
"Fries or salad?"
"If I were going to eat fries, I would eat the bun, dude."
He pursed his lips and scribbled on his pad.
The ahi salad with no wontons and dressing on the side, Gwendolyn said, thrusting her menu at him.
When he was gone, she said,
You think I don't know fame's complicated? I have a full-time security guard at my house. People keep coming out of the woodwork asking me for money. I'm under a lot of pressure to write.
It's not the same as for me and Oliver. People don't buy magazines because you're on the cover. Nobody takes your picture when you put gas in your car. No one cares enough what you look like naked to hack your phone. Anyway, you're not under that much pressure to write. Just stop. Wrap it up.
My readers want more. I do it for them.
Oh, please.
You'd be nothing without me.
Her dog, whose head she was stroking so hard the whites of its eyes showed, started whining.
A face on a lunchbox nobody buys at a garage sale. A dead girl on CSI. A loser trading blowjobs for new headshots. I created an entire universe. I made up a story that's worth billions of dollars. What have you ever done? What have you ever made?
Before then, I hadn't decided what I was going to do. If I was going to smooth things over or blow things up. But now, I had clarity. I leaned forward. Whenever someone reads your books or even mentions your books, you know who they picture? Me. I didn't know someone so small could emanate so much anger. It was palpable, heat and vibration. She was like a space capsule re-entering the atmosphere. Okay, the waiter said, swanning up. An ahi salad and the cheeseburger. No wontons, no dressing. No bun, no fries. He set down the plates. Is there anything else I can bring you before you enjoy your lunches? No, thank you. I gave him my most gracious, star-being-gracious smile. When he was gone, I stood up. This has been a pleasant and professional interaction, I said to Gwendolyn. But I'm afraid I really must be going. She looked up at me, at a loss for how to best communicate her hatred. I dug in my pocket and slapped a flash drive down on the table. A memento, I said. 5. It looks about like what you'd think. We made it on Oliver's phone, so there's lots of blurry jostling and shots of nostrils and armpits and double chins. And at one point, the phone falls off the bed. Not the best production values in our extended universe. Oliver kept calling timeouts, during which I would sit there twiddling my thumbs while he got another close-up of his dick all by itself, like he was Hitchcock and his dick was Grace Kelly. I wanted to delete the video as soon as we'd finished, but Oliver wouldn't let me. I'm sentimental, he said. So we both kept copies on USB drives that we locked up. Nothing hackable. Mutually assured destruction, I said. Though, of course, it wasn't. The night before my lunch with Gwendolyn, I'd watched the video before I made the copy. I may have been a little drunk, and afterward I called Oliver, but he didn't answer. I thought I should go somewhere, but I couldn't think of anywhere. I thought I should fuck someone, but the only person I wanted to fuck was Alexei, and that wasn't happening.
This isn't who I am, he'd said when he broke off our stubby little affair. I don't do this.
Well, I said, I can't help but notice that you do. I knew Alexei was a ruthlessly good agent, a shark that only eats money, but he was also a family man. He chose her, his wife, and them, his son and two daughters.
I say that like it was some big surprise. We'd only hooked up twice. Once on location in New Zealand, and once back in LA. What did I expect? That he would give up his whole life for me? Sign on for a big scandal? Hitch himself to some girl who hadn't finished college? Did I even want him to?
You don't understand, Alexei said. I don't have the benefit of the doubt, ever. If this got out, you can't imagine the shitstorm for me. It would be way worse than if I were white.
You're worried what other people think? I said. He looked at me like I'd started speaking in tongues.
Yeah,
he said. When our things started, I was filming the second Archangel in New Zealand, which was standing in for Archangel's less icebound colony, Murjansk. Alexei had come to check on Oliver, but Oliver told him to go enjoy himself instead of hanging around set. Oliver told me I should go, too, since I had the day off. Make the most of it, he said. Alexei suggested we visit a system of caves where you put on a wetsuit and float through on an inner tube, and it's totally dark except for glowworms. They live on the cave ceilings and walls, and their tails shine like stars and attract flies and mosquitoes as they hatch. The poor bugs think they're flying into the night sky, when really, they're just flapping up to get eaten. In the dark, my tube bumped against Alexei's, and I grabbed his cold neoprene arm like one boat tying up to another. The only sounds were dripping and lapping. The glassy rustle of water, us breathing, all of it quietly echoing. The black water reflected 1,000 points of worm light. We rotated slowly. I closed my eyes, and when I opened them, I felt as though I were staring into the heart of the universe. My eyes hurt, and my skin was tight across my face from looking so hard.
Didn't you feel,
Alexei said later, in the car when we were about to drive back to the hotel,
like being in that cave and being out in space could have been the same thing? Like the difference didn't really matter.
I turned to him, excited, worried my excitement would make me seem childlike. But his face reflected back my own enthusiasm. My own self-consciousness about being so thrilled by a tourist trap. Our wetsuits and tubes and the polo shirts of the employees were all emblazoned with Worm Cave Adventure. Our worm light filled the car. Exactly, I said. That's exactly how I felt. It was the sky, even though it wasn't. I told him how when I was little, I thought the stars were perforations in the sky, little pinpricks into some other surrounding universe that was only light. He told me that his dad liked to say the stars were lanterns hung out by the past so the lost could find their way.
He thought he was so deep, Alexei said.
That night, we were late to dinner with Oliver because we'd been in bed. But we weren't having sex when we lost track of time. I mean, we'd had sex, but we were lying there talking, making those first big, careless, gleeful excavations when everything about someone is new and unknown. Before you have to get out your little picks and brushes, work tediously around the fragile, buried stuff. I wanted to know everything. I wanted to tell everything. We didn't even notice the daylight fading in the room because the glow between us was so bright.
You guys seem to get along, Oliver said later,
in a different bed, in the same hotel, stroking my stomach, trying to get me interested in sex, which worked because I was still all keyed up. He's a nice guy, I said. We had a good day.
When I got back to LA, Alexei asked if he could come to my house, bring me lunch. And I shaved and fussed and obsessed over what to wear, cutoffs, old button-down, and changed my sheets and gave Augustina the afternoon off. And while we sat by the pool eating the grain bowls he'd brought from a pretentious salad place, he told me we had to stop. "This isn't who I am," he said. "I don't do this. I have a family." I asked why he'd done it in the first place.
"I'm weak," he said.
I looked at the avocado and amaranth in my bowl, at the papery bougainvillea blossoms sailing along the surface of my pool like little magenta boats. In retrospect, I think Alexei found weakness easier to admit to than the warm light. Maybe he was already thinking about what version of the story his wife would find simplest to forgive if she ever found out. A momentary lapse in judgment, or a powerful infatuation. Maybe he was thinking about which version he'd rather live with. Or maybe he was telling the plain truth. And meanwhile, I'd been laboring eagerly up toward a bunch of fake stars. I made a helpless gesture. "If that's how you feel."
"It's not how I feel. It's how it is."
In the moment, I had to do anything I could to change the way I was feeling. So I went to stand in front of Alexei, between his legs.
"Hadley,"
he said in a resigned voice. But he held the backs of my thighs and rested his forehead on my stomach. He'd taken off his suit jacket, and his dreadlocks were bound in a neat bundle down his back against his crisp white shirt.
"I think it's the illicitness, to be honest,"
he murmured, almost to himself.
"You're coated in it like sugar. Without that,"
I said, "I'd be dull and disgusting instead of sparkly and delicious." I stared off at the far corner of my yard, where my landscaper, an expert in drought-resistant plants, had planted rows of spiked and serrated yucca and agave and palms, ranks of them, like marching soldiers waving their weapons.
"I just mean, how much of this is the thrill?"
His hands were moving on my legs. "I guess we'll never know." So, yeah, that was the second time. Probably Alexei was the one I was really sticking it to when I made a spectacle of myself with Jones.
House of Virtue. Missoula, March 1929. A year and a half after Marion's haircut. The day had been warm, and a sense, not quite a sound, of buried melting had prevailed. Of subterranean trickling beneath the snow. The river, open at its middle, flowed black and narrow between broad white banks. But in the evening, the city had contracted and hardened again. Clouds came over the mountains, promising more snow. A delivery truck rattled across the railroad tracks away from downtown, its side panels advertising Stanley's bread and cake. At the wheel, Marion kept to the low gears, followed frozen ruts packed by earlier wheels, calmly countering slips and slides. She must not get stuck in snow or mud, must generally avoid drawing attention to what an unusual delivery driver she made, a girl of 14, tall now as some men, but skinny in overalls and a sheepskin jacket and a brown muffler knitted by Barrett, cap pulled low over her cropped hair. The police got their cut to leave her alone, but no good came from indiscretion. She delivered bread and cakes, yes, but also, tucked under Mr. Stanley's signature calico covers in the delivery baskets, were bottles. Bottles had been the answer. After she'd cut off her hair and could be taken for a boy, voice kept to a mumble, face turned to her shoes, farmers sometimes hired her as a cheap hand. But picking apples and sawing pumpkin stems brought little income. Shelving books brought less. Her only ideas for making the kind of money she needed, opening up an auto mechanic shop, for example, were not the kinds of things a 14-year-old girl, no matter how audacious, could do. As she lay on the sleeping porch after a day of farm work, sunburned and with aching arms, a wisp of recollection had come to her. Caleb had once sold empty bottles to a moonshiner up the valley. He'd earned enough to keep himself in candy for weeks. But the work had struck him as drudgery. "I'm not digging around in the garbage for that old coot," Caleb had said. But Marion didn't mind digging. Potshot Norman, the moonshiner was called. She knew his cabin and the shed where he kept his still. Walking in the woods, she'd smelled the hot mash. So she had gathered her nerve and knocked on his door, which cracked open to reveal a profusion of wild white hair and beard around startled, darting eyes. "Eh?" he said, as though she'd already spoken and he'd misheard. "Need any bottles, mister? I can bring you bottles if you need them." He nodded, chewing his lips.
"Always need bottles, don't I?"
Dimes for gallons, nickels for quarts, 2.5 cents for pints. She rustled in the alleys behind the speakeasies and soda shops and pharmacies, around the city dump, in the chaotic backyards of drunks. She filled sacks with empties, green and amber and clear. Some had labels stuck on them: premium Canadian whiskey, premium English gin. Most were probably counterfeit, printed by bootleggers. But some were likely authentic, even if the booze would have been cut with water and grain alcohol. Potshot, scrupulous in his way, boiled off the labels before he poured in his white lightning. Marion traded her sacks for bills and coins. Eventually, Potshot told her he didn't need any more bottles for a while, and sent her to see Mr. Stanley, the baker, who bought what she had, amused. One day, Mr. Stanley stood smoking in the back door of his bakery while she pulled her clattering sacks from Wallace's car, baking bread, cooking mash, smells that might reasonably be confused, though Stanley had other stills squirreled away around the valley. Stanley said,
"How'd you like to expand your business, boyo?"
"I'm always looking for business," she said, a small crisis of conscience. "But you know I'm not a boy."
"It's a girl under there?"
He bent to peer beneath her cap brim. Narrowed eyes, a cloud of smoke, flower dust on hairy forearms. She was sure he was putting her on, indulging her disguise.
"All right. Well, how'd you like to expand your business, girlie?"
By the time she crossed the railroad tracks, Marion had visited 6 houses, a veterans club, 2 doctors' offices, and 4 restaurants. The dusk sky sagged with unfallen snow. At each stop, she delivered baskets, some with only baked goods, some only liquor, some both. She knocked on doors. She descended into cellars. She took money from inside certain birdhouses and certain hollow trees and left bottles behind. Stanley didn't let her make the big deliveries to speakeasies and roadhouses, which required more stealth and odder hours and ran the risk of hijacking. He kept her to the small orders. A pouch strung on a cord around her neck, slowly filled with bills and coins. And after each round, she handed the cash to Stanley, who peeled off a few bills for her, which she took home and deposited in one of her hiding places in the cottage. Hollowed out books, a pouch buttoned to the underside of the armchair. Stanley didn't mind she was a girl. His other bottle men had stolen booze, tried to steal business. She didn't. The previous summer, she'd told Wallace she intended to leave school after her 14th birthday. He'd been in his studio. He set down his brush, wiped his hands with a rag. "But why, Marion?" he said. "There is so much to learn." "I want to work. I've already started driving Mr. Stanley's delivery truck." Wallace settled into an armchair, gesturing her into the other.
"I'd heard."
He wouldn't interrogate her about what she delivered. He wouldn't want to know. He'd already know anyway. She said, "The law says I only have to finish eighth grade, and it's not fair you're still having to take care of us when you didn't want us. I'll pay you good money for room and board." He blinked as though she had clapped her hands in front of his face, waking him from a hypnotized state. "What do you mean I didn't want you?" "You've been doing a good deed. You didn't choose to live this way." "But it's not true. Marion, you are wanted. You didn't want the responsibility." He gazed around at his unfinished paintings, his mess of brushes and paint tubes. Unconsciously, he checked his watch as though in hopes of remembering a conflicting appointment. "And what do you imagine doing without an education? Driving Stanley's truck forever?" She'd told him 1,000 times already, "I'm going to be a pilot." He drooped. "Still this. I have to save up for flying lessons, but I'll pay you $5 a week for room and board. If I don't, if I come up short even once, I'll go back to school." She didn't tell him she'd already asked all the pilots in town if they would give her lessons, and none would. There was a real airfield now, out by the fairgrounds, with a few small hangars and offices and a fuel pump. Her teacher had not arrived yet, but he would. She knew he would. She could see the promise of $5 a week had snagged Wallace's interest, but he only echoed, "A pilot." He thought for a minute, his paint-flecked hands resting on his knees. "I know you like planes, but Marion, I don't mean to be unkind, but even if you learn to fly, to what end? You want to be like that Breyfogle woman living hand to mouth? Getting old with no house, no children, nothing settled? That swell of a husband of hers, if they were even married, and I doubt it, will run off at some point, and then where will she be? What do you think becomes of a woman like that?"
"I have to be a pilot. I'll do it whether I go to school or not."
"Then go to school.
You ran away to be an artist, even though it wasn't practical."
"It was different for me."
"Why should it be?"
"Don't be obtuse, Marion, because I'm a man."
"Don't worry about me. You never have. Why start now?" He was looking at one of his canvases, a hillside of flaxen grass, a band of cloud.
"If you and Jamie hadn't come..."
He trailed off, started again.
"Maybe sometimes I wished I were completely unencumbered, but I would have been worse off if I were. I'm trying to say I think it was a good thing you came, that I had to be responsible for someone, even if I wasn't always attentive."
He sighed and pinched the bridge of his nose, closing his eyes.
"Marion, the truth is, I'm ashamed, but I don't have it in me to make you go to school next year if you're set against it."
"You don't?"
"No."
She jumped up, bent to embrace him, kiss his cheek. "Thank you, Wallace. Thank you so much."
"Don't thank me, child. I'm failing you."
In Stanley's truck, she was on her way to Miss Dolly's parlor house. The first few lazy snowflakes sifted through the headlights. Miss Dolly, a glum, melted candle of a woman, had dug in and kept her bordello running on West Front Street after the cleanup of 1916 shut down almost all the others. Her soiled dove coat cooing discreetly for some years on a block otherwise gone dark and quiet. Girls from the other houses, houses that closed, had to work out of sooty, lightless basement cribs, poking their heads up into the alleys like lascivious gophers. Miss Dolly's girls would have done anything to avoid going to cribs and worked hard, though they resented the debt Dolly kept them in for rent and meals, even for laundry and bath water and heating their curling irons on the stove and every other thing she could think of. Miss Dolly held on downtown even after the Chinese left and took with them their noodle shops and laundries and the herbalists who kept buns out of the girls' ovens.
She held on after mechanics and upholsterers and the Salvation Army moved in down the block, after the once fine parlor house next door was bought by a sausage maker. She kept her girls out of the front windows where they'd been accustomed to sit and rap on the glass at passers-by with knitting needles or thimbles. In the good old days, what a marvelous rattle went up on payday nights, as loud as miners' hammers and even more profitable. Miss Dolly could get misty-eyed just at the sound of glasses clinking or dice in a cup. A fire, for which she at times darkly blamed the police and at times a bankrupted rival and at times the anti-liquor, anti-vice women, finally brought about her relocation to an unobtrusive brick house on the north side of the tracks. There was no sign out front to advertise female boarding, let alone female companionship. Customers knew to come in the back. Near as she could get to Miss Dolly's, Marion parked the truck and unloaded a runnered sled from the back that she piled with the two baskets containing the weekly order. Down the darkening street she trudged, pulling the sled behind her. One of the girls, Belle, opened the kitchen door. "You," she said to Marion. "Come in." She was not done up for callers, but wore a plain blue drop-waisted dress with wool stockings and a gray shawl, her hair pulled into a low knot. Only her heavy rouge and coal gave any suggestion of her profession. Marion had one of the baskets in her arms. "There's another one on the sled." Belle scooted outside in her slippers, came chasing back in with the second basket, herding Marion into the kitchen. "Good thing you came. We'd almost run out," Belle said. She said this every time, apparently oblivious to the precision with which Miss Dolly doled out each week's supply. Miss Dolly also bought imported booze from a real legger, actual premium scotch and gin for the big spenders, but most of her customers were happy enough to drink Mr. Stanley's cheap moon. "Sit and visit for a while. Dolly's not here." Marion should have been on her way, but she was always flattered by the attentions of Miss Dolly's girls. She took off her coat and hat and sat at the table. "Did Dolly leave money for the order?" "I'm sure I don't know." Belle peeked into one of the baskets and squealed, flinging back the calico cover. A custard tart rested on top of the bottles. In the other basket, with even greater delight, she discovered half a dozen cream puffs, each sealed in its own envelope of waxed paper. Presents for the girls from Mr. Stanley, who came around from time to time.
"Let's have one," Belle said. "Just one. We'll split it."
She was already up, fetching a knife. Once she'd sliced the puff in two, she pushed her half greedily into her mouth with manicured fingers. Marion took a bite of hers. Both the pastry and the cream, cold from the truck, were firm and delicious. Belle, still chewing, squinted at her. Miss Dolly's girls were so accustomed to done-up faces and curled hair that Marion's boyishness struck them as improper and troubling. Belle reached out and brushed at Marion's hair, trying to part it with her fingertips.
"I've told you, you ought to quit chopping this so short," she said. "It looks funny."
"I like it."
"Your uncle doesn't mind you cutting it?"
Wallace was known at Miss Dolly's.
"He doesn't try to stop me."
"Our housekeeper does. She hides the scissors."
"You cut it yourself?"
"No, my friend Caleb does." Belle hitched one shoulder flirtatiously.
"Must be a good friend if you let him cut your hair. I don't let anyone touch mine except Cora. She has a way. I keep telling her she should quit and become a hairdresser."
Marion thought of her last haircut, of Caleb looking at her naked torso afterward while her neck and shoulders were still itchy with trimmings. Around Miss Dolly's girls, she was all sharp curiosity. She observed how they fussed with their cobbled-together little frilly outfits, how they switched in a blink from coquettish posing and vamping to bored slumping and lounging. The pull, the density of their femaleness, intrigued her, even if she preferred pretending more or less to be a boy. Dolly's girls were gossipy and lazy and hard, but something about them seemed important. They were a clue to a mystery she had not quite identified. For a time, Caleb's price had been only to kiss her. She had let in his tongue, the odd muscular wetness of it. After her most recent haircut, he had calmly unbuttoned her shirt and pushed it off her shoulders, gazed at her naked chest. She'd felt like those paintings of Jesus where he was flayed open, his heart exposed and radiating light. When Caleb had reached out and brushed her nipple with his thumb, though, she'd shoved him away, and he'd laughed the way he did after he'd picked a pocket. Belle got up and went to the kitchen sink, wetted her hands before working more forcefully.